This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Today's sponsor is The Reason Webathon, which runs through the end of Monday, December 4th. Once a year, we ask our readers, viewers, and listeners to make tax-deductible donations to support our principled libertarian journalism. Go to reason.com/donate right now to see giving levels and associated swag. This is a bonus episode, and I'm very excited to share it with you. A few weeks back at our Washington, D.C. HQ, Reason Features editor Peter Suderman talked with former Reason editor-in-chief Virginia Postrel and American Enterprise Institute fellow Jim Pethakoukas about the future, why it matters, why it's misunderstood, and how we might get a better one. Both have written extensively on the topic. Postrel is the author of many books, including The Future and Its Enemies. And Pethakoukas is the author of the just-released book, The Conservative Futurist, How to Create the Sci-Fi World We Were Promised. It's a great conversation about economics, progress, science fiction, and kitchen gadgets. Here is The Reason Interview with Virginia Postrel and Jim Pethakoukas.
Hello. Welcome to the new Reason headquarters. This is the inaugural event, the first time we are testing this fully operational libertarian battle station. So thank you very, very much for coming tonight on a Monday. I know you all have many other things that you could be doing, so we're glad that you are here. Like I said, this is the first time we have ever had the public in this office, so you should take a look around. I strongly recommend taking a peek into the men's bathroom. The wallpaper is great. All gender men's bathroom.
No, the women's bathroom is the all gender one.
I actually haven't seen it, so I couldn't comment. So tonight we're going to talk about something that matters a lot to all of us, the future. We're going to talk about why it matters, why it's awesome, and how we're going to get there. Also, we're going to talk a lot about science fiction. You're welcome, nerds. I know there are a few of you here. Joining me in this conversation are two people who have greatly influenced my own view of the future. First, we have Virginia Postrel. She is the former editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. She's also the author of numerous books, including The Power of Glamour, The Fabric of Civilization, which you can purchase in the hallway, strongly recommend, and the book The Future and Its Enemies, which is highly relevant to tonight's discussion. And then second, we also have Jim Pethakoukas. He is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, author of the just-released book, The Conservative Futurist, How to Create the Sci-Fi World We Were Promised. He also writes a Substack, Faster Please. It's great. Strongly recommend you subscribe to that. So both Virginia and Jim represent what I like to think of as the pro-future community. They think the future is good. They're in favor of it, as am I. But they have some disagreements about precisely how those of us in the pro-future community should think about the project of building a better world and a better tomorrow. And those disagreements revolve heavily around what I like to think of as the two big problems for futurists, the past and the present. Also, there are a lot of disagreements that for some reason, involve the Jetsons. So we're going to talk a lot about the Jetsons tonight. Rutro. Right, so Jim, I want to start with you because you have a new book out here. The title of the book is The Conservative Futurist, and this sounds like an oxymoron to me. Aren't conservatives supposed to be the people standing athwart history yelling stop? It sounds like you are standing on the edge of history looking into the horizon yelling, please come faster, more.
Faster, please. That's what I'm saying. Let's go. Let's hurry up. And one reason I take that attitude is because for pretty much my entire life, we've been in a period of unexpected stagnation. Now, there has been progress. There has been economic growth. Certainly, like I said, technological progress. But not what people in the first decades after World War II thought we would have. Far, far less. And that has been pretty much my entire life. So when anyone says, with the idea of, pausing AI, I'm like, we've been there. We've done that. I cannot believe that we're going to say pause to another technology, for what I think are not particularly good reasons. And the reason the book is called The Conservative Futurist, part of its truth in labeling, I'm a conservative of the what I think at least I mean whatever this word means today. The way I define it is of the American kind, which what we're trying to conserve is the tremendous liberal heritage of liberal democracy, of free markets, a belief in social mobility. That is a tremendous inheritance that I not only do I want to preserve because it's I think it served us well. And I think you can build a future on that foundation. And you know, as we found out, not everybody thinks that.
Isn't that just the fact that we didn't get the future that people expected in the 1950s, just sort of a restatement of that old straw about how predictions are hard, especially about the future? I mean, it's just a prediction problem, right?
Peter, the future is where we are all going to spend the rest of our lives. Do you not grasp that very simple? You know, one thing I do is this book does not contain a lot of predictions. When a futurist is someone who makes lots of predictions, and the more you make, the greater the odds maybe one of them will come true. Having spent a lot of my life covering Wall Street, that there's a saying like when you make a forecast, give a number and a date, not both. The market will be up 10% at some point. I'm not making predictions. My version of futurism is creating an environment in which I hope that the kind of opportunity and future that we would like to live in is possible. So it's about really creating the environment, sort of the policy garden, you may say, for creating a future. I don't have a specific vision that we all need to live, in these cities under bubble domes or under the sea. That may be the future, but I don't believe we need like a department of the future determining exactly what that future will look like.
I do hope we live more like SpongeBob at some point in my life. Virginia, I know you have a lot of agreements with Jim, but I actually want to zero in on some of the disagreements tonight because I think that's going to be the most productive discussion. So since I asked Jim about the title of his book, I'm going to ask you about the subtitle of his book, because the subtitle is How to Create the Sci-Fi World We Were Promised. The world we were promised, that sounds kind of nostalgic. That sounds like it's kind of looking backwards in some ways. And so I guess I'm sort of wondering how you view that retro sensibility and that view of the past that says, well, in the 1950s, in the 1960s, in that post-war era where we were building the modern world, they all thought that everything was going to be awesome, and they were really happy about the future. Do you think that's right?
Not exactly.
Okay.
So first of all, I should say that as the oldest person on this panel, I can remember the things that you can only read about, including spending my kindergarten year reading Times, reading You Will Go to the Moon, which... I did not realize that it also said I would be a spaceman, but I totally believe that book, and it is what was my favorite book. So that's, I come to this with a little cred.
Even in the 1980s, I often told my parents that I wanted to be, that I wanted to work in space because I had watched too much Star Trek.
Although now I'm like, no, I would not like to do that. It's too uncomfortable. But the thing that we have to realize when we look back at mid-century visions of the future is we have to think about the generation that grew up with those visions and why they turned against them. And I think, obviously not everybody, because, here I am. But there was a reaction against the world of that mid-century world. It was a reaction against leveling neighborhoods in order to build high-rise towers that would look like the classic visions of the future, including the Jetsons, which for some reason everyone lives in the sky. It was a reaction against the notion of synthetics wonder fabrics, wonder drugs, wonder, you know, but against the artificiality. Again, I love everything artificial personally, but there was a real reaction. And I think if we take seriously the notion of progress as a process where discontent drives innovation, we have to take seriously the critiques that people had, and not just political people, but everyday people. Why didn't they like eating Wonder Bread all the time? Why did they, you know, why did they want to preserve landscapes? Why did they not want to have urban renewal? Some of these things are, some of these, notably urban renewal, the protests against that led to a lot of the vetocracy we have today, where you can't build anything, which is terrible, but it didn't come out of nowhere. And so when you make these diagnoses, you have to think about the what led to where we are, as well as just like, I don't like where we are.
So you, what you're talking about, what you're describing is a kind of practical problem-solving approach to progress, in which it's not enthusiasm for the gee whiz wow factor of the future. Instead, it's more like something isn't working, and here's something that makes my life better. And that's what progress is.
Yeah, so the idea that I develop in The Future and Its Enemies is this bottom-up idea, where does progress come from? And there are lots of aspects to it, but one of them is what Henry Petrosky, who's written a lot of books about innovation, calls form follows failure. And the idea is whenever you invent something, you know, a water bottle, a chair, whatever, as soon as you have that thing, because he is thinking about artifacts, you see what you don't like about it. So humans are eternally discontent. Otherwise, progress would have no meaning. Otherwise, we would just get to the end and that would be it. And we could just all sit back and relax. That discontent is something that is inevitably part of progress. And so those images, going back to the 1939 fair, there's an ad I love from it's right toward the end of World War II. This is like, it's an ad from the gas company, and it's this woman who says, "I'll live like a princess in a house that runs by magic." You know, what people were discontent with in the first half of the 20th century was drudgery. It was struggle. It was difficulty getting places. It was living in crowded conditions. It was lots of things that were, in fact, addressed in the post-war era. And so then those people came up and they were the graduate, you know, unhappy in their affluence.
So you've already mentioned synthetic products and your love of them. I, too, love synthetic products, with some exceptions. So one of my interests, as probably some of you in the audience know, is that I write about and consume classic cocktails. And one thing that happened in the post-war era was that cocktail making started to use a product called Sour Mix. And Sour Mix was there because juicing a lemon takes a little bit of time. And making sugar syrup and combining it with the fresh juice of a lemon takes even more time. And so what somebody did was they thought, well, you know what? We could just make a shelf-stable product that combines both of those things, and then you'll never have to juice a lemon, and you'll never have to make your own syrup, and you'll never have to combine them. You'll just have it there, and it will be on your shelf, and it will last forever, and it will taste awful. But this was also the era of TV dinners and frozen food. The frozen food revolution started a little before World War II, but really kicked off in the 1950s and 1960s. And then there was a backlash to that, where people sort of thought, well, fresh is actually better. But now we live in a world, of course, where you can have both, and where you can have cheap, delicious frozen pizza, and you can also have incredibly expensive and elaborate and really sort of perfected and fussed over frozen pizza. And so I want to actually go back to that world, the post-war era, of where synthetic products and where also labor-saving devices, especially in the kitchen but elsewhere in the home, were really changing life, especially for women. And I want to talk about the Jetsons, since we, because we previewed this, right? Because the Jetsons was, in some ways, that vision of the future of let's take the revolutions, the synthetics and labor-saving revolutions of the 1950s, and let's extend them forward forever. That was, in some ways, the premise for the show. So, Jim, you are more of a fan of the show, or at least what it represents. Tell us what you think of that show and sort of how you think about it and its view of the future. For those who don't remember, The Jetsons was this sci-fi cartoon about a family. Yeah, like living with like a robot servant and a flying car and a talking dog.
It was the Honeymooners in the future.
It was also the Flintstones, except with robots instead of dinosaurs. But Jim, tell us what you think about The Jetsons and why it's important.
Well, I think the people who made, the creators of The Jetsons, thought they were not making a piece of science fantasy. It's not as if you were making Star Wars. You thought eventually that was going to be the future of the human race, of humanity. They thought that they were building on technologies already in the works. That was you know, maybe somewhat exaggerated, but that would be the future, that we would have flying cars and we would certainly have robots and you know, skyscrapers and, you know, push button machines. And you would be able to, in the very opening episode, the daughter, Judy, I think, is going to take a brief vacation, not a vacation, but just for the afternoon, she was going to fly to South America or something and back in just an afternoon. I think they thought that was realistic. That's what was going to happen. And so it really reflects, I think, a feeling in the period that the kinds of things which may seem science fictional to us now were considered by, you know, people who were called themselves futurists at the time, you know, public intellectuals, people worked at think tanks, CEOs, thought that that is what something like that was would actually happen. That would be built on very rapid economic growth, economic productivity growth, and technological progress. There was this big meeting in 1968. Among these kinds of, you know, not people who wrote science fiction, but people who were, you know, again, academics and CEOs, businessmen, executives, and it was supposed to be what would the world look like in 2018, and it was very Jetsons-like. It was we would control the weather and jetpacks, and one thing they absolutely were convinced of is that the booming 1960s would never end. We did not have to worry anymore about economic downturns. So that sort of deep enthusiasm, whether or not it actually manifested in a particular vision of the future, you know, flying cars or, you know, or space colonies, they believed it was going to be better and there would be more. And we had sort of licked the problem of economic downturns and we would just be a much, much richer, so rich, in fact, that we would have a variety of cocktail mixes, right? Many. And remember, we are a much richer society than we were in the 1960s. And so whatever you want, you would have access to. And Alvin Toffler, who wrote maybe the best-selling futurist book of all time, called Future Shock, bestseller, 1970, a book based on the premise that economic growth and change was so rapid it would drive us all insane very quickly. When he realized, when that didn't happen, when in fact we had a slowdown, he told Wired magazine in 1990 that, well, the economists had tricked him. They blew it, and that's why that prediction didn't happen.
It is amazing to go back and look at quotes from senior economic policy officials from the 1960s in particular, where they just would say, oh, we have the economy solved. We can just run this thing now. And they believed it was entirely in their hands, that it was a matter of just dialing the levers right. And this was, you know, in the United States, which was at the time like locked in a kind of existential battle with communism, which also in some ways had some of the same sort of vision of like, we can just control the economy. And obviously the 70s then came along and proved them wrong. Part of what I think, to go back to cocktails, because I'm going to keep pulling us back to cocktails, because it's important,
metaphor for the discussion.
But is that now we're so rich that we can spend the time to juice the lemon and make the syrups and to pay other people $18 for a cocktail, to pay other people to do that for us. But part of the thing that I think about in the 1950s and 60s all the time is, so my wife is very interested in just in sort of domestic domestic technology and the history of domestic technology. And we have around our house old guidebooks and reference books and even manuals for always directed very explicitly at housewives for the gadgets that they would be acquiring for the first time. And if you read the guidebooks that like GE and the kind of comparable companies of the 1930s and 40s were putting out for your first refrigerator, the companies themselves treat their products like a kind of magic. And it was in a way, right? Like it was a totally new way of thinking about shopping and cooking and preserving food. And so in some ways, that's what informed the Jetsons and part of that vision of the future is
we would have nuclear
is that people had lived through it. Yeah, right. Right, but people had lived through this period of great transformation and change. At the same time, Virginia, I know you see the Jetsons nostalgia somewhat differently.
Yeah, I think it's about style mostly. I mean, it's you know, people like the forms. They like the way the Jetsons looks.
The way everyone was wearing triangles all the time for some reason?
Yeah, more about the way the houses look.
Why are my clothes not a triangle?
Right, because it looks like the future, you know. Yeah, so I think that actually, I think there are a lot of things going on. One is what both of you alluded to was sort of the high point of Keynesian confidence in the ability to manage the economy and keep it growing forever. And that, you know, met reality in the 70s. There was also this slowdown starting in 73, which there's a lot of competing theories about why it happened. None of them completely satisfactory, but it clearly did happen. We're a lot richer than we were in the 60s or early 70s, but today, but we're a lot less rich than we would have been if that slowdown hadn't happened. Another thing that happened, which I was thinking about the kitchen gadgets, and I was thinking about like microwave ovens, which didn't exist in the Jetsons or in the 60s, really. And one thing that, this is very nerdy, one problem
Great.
Is that a lot of the advances that have taken place in everyday life have happened in markets that are so competitive that the value created has gone almost entirely to consumers and therefore not into the GDP or any of those calculations. We really see this once you get the digital
revolution. So just explain that briefly for people who don't do macroeconomic policy.
Yeah, so
there's probably at least a couple here.
So GDP doesn't count your happiness or your satisfaction with a product, what economists would call willingness to pay. If you don't have to pay as much as you would be willing to pay, you get this surplus. Again, very nerdy. But it doesn't get measured anywhere because it doesn't go to any company's bottom line. Once you get the digital revolution, this becomes very important in the economic statistics. But I would argue that it actually probably is taking place earlier on too, especially in these domestic spheres, because these appliances and stuff are pretty competitive industries. And, you know, one of the greatest inventions ever was the washing machine. You know, if you ever read about what laundry was like before the washing machine, you can't even imagine.
It was a full day.
It is the first
for
thing.
For most women who stayed at home.
Right.
It was a full day of their week. That's what they did.
It is the first thing that people who have any money send out for, even in developing countries today. But anyway, that happens in the 20s. But in The Power of Glamour, I write about people, some surveys of British moviegoers in the like 30s and 40s. And they were like watching these American movies and being amazed, not just at the stuff that's supposed to be rich people, but just like people had refrigerators and they were hoovering. We would say vacuuming. And it seemed like magic. So, you know, there were these sort of miraculous things that took place. And that did shape an expectation of the future, which has been somewhat disappointed.
So in that period, right after World War II, people had lived through and were living through a period of great disruption to their lives. Change for the better in many cases, because they had all of these devices, these gee whiz labor-saving devices that were both making their lives better and just making them different, so that in a way that they could see really directly and minutely every single day. And that informed their view. And then something happened. And so we've already talked a little bit about the 1970s, but both of you in your own ways have sort of have written about and described something happened to change how people felt about this stuff, about the future in general and their expectations. What would you, Jim, what would you say sort of, what were some of the factors that changed people's views here? What were, who were the naysayers, and how did we come to have a different view of the future?
I think for me, the primary explanation about what changed was that we got richer. And one which seems to be a universal constant is when a country gets richer, they start to think a lot more about the downsides of the process that made them rich. They begin to think a lot more about the environment, about the quality of the air, about polluted soil, all the whole process of industrialization, all the pollution, and that. So I think to me, the fact that we had more of a focus on the downsides to progress by the 1960s, that to me is not surprising at all. And on top of that, you had, concerns about, even though the atomic age sounded great, people became more aware of what happened at Hiroshima and radiation, and that became like a scary thing that was not completely obvious to people in the 1940s. You had books like Silent Spring, which was a phenomenal bestseller.
Phenomenal in the sense of it sold a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe not phenomenal in the sense of really great.
So people who were concerned about this sort of the conformist society being sort of imposed by big business. They were concerned about pollution. And then you have the Vietnam War, which kind of confirmed a lot of their fears about bigness and American institutions. And to them, the kind of pollution going into rivers, was that really that much different than us dropping napalm or Agent Orange? So then he had the Vietnam War. So I think all those things happening, really set the foundation for it became a longer term change in sort of how we thought about the future. And one reason I wrote the book, or it first popped in my head, was a great study by this economist from Yale, who just looked at sort of two things. One, how much money do we start spending as a share of GDP on infrastructure, and what was the state of our national debt? And those all changed. The first went down, the second went up. And from that, he concludes that somewhere in the early 70s, we became a less future-oriented society. And then he ran down like 30 different reasons of why. And he's like, I don't know. Maybe it's not an answerable problem. A lot of what my book does is think about what are the possible answers. What changed in our culture? What changed what changed in our economy? And some of the things that changed in the economy were always going to change, but then other things we did to ourselves.
Virginia, about 25 years ago, you wrote a book, as I said, titled The Future and Its Enemies. There were many enemies of the future at the time. I imagine you think there are still some. Who are today's enemies of the future?
Well, as Jim alluded to, people, it's been very interesting to observe a split among people who are concerned about climate change. There are the people who are right, who say that means we need to build lots of nuclear plants, power plants, and we need to stop with this weird taboo about what is in fact a pretty safe way of making generating electricity and one that doesn't have emissions.
And then for every decade. I mean, it was more dangerous.
It's safer than it was, right? But it still was significantly safer than, say, coal plants, even without considering any of today's concerns. The other side takes what I would consider a purity taboo view, which is not based on actual environmental harms, but is based on a kind of conviction these things are good and these things are bad. And, you know, it's like, don't mix milk and meat, whatever. It's a religious taboo that creates a sense of tribalism. So one thing that happened in around that, 1973 turndown is, as Jim said, a lot more environmental regulation, which was to be expected given people are richer. But how exactly it was implemented was not necessarily in the most efficient way of providing what people wanted while enabling progress to take place. Another thing that happened was a cutback in the ability to produce energy, which is very important if you want to do like anything. So today I would say, some of the things that I'm heartened by, but also appalled by, I am heartened by the increasing YIMBY pushback against the many restrictions on the ability to build, particularly housing, that were implemented, starting in the 70s. But I remember being in LA in the late 80s when growth was considered a bad thing and they were putting on all these regulations. I was going to say, what's going to happen? We're going to go from a place where housing is very affordable to one where it isn't. And lo and behold, we did. So you still see the kinds of cross-political alliances that I was writing about for good and ill in the future and its enemies. And the other thing that we're seeing is this rise of populism internationally, where trade is bad, migration is bad, change is bad, and people are going to run on that. And that is quite concerning.
So the thing that both of you talked about here, the overlap, is environmentalism. And both of you described a kind of environmentalism that you see as an enemy of progress, an enemy of building more things, of having more energy, an enemy of becoming a wealthier, more efficient society that can do more. But I guess I just want to ask you sort of what seems like a very basic question. Isn't it good to care about the environment? I mean, just before we were, having this conversation, I was looking out the window and looking at the beautiful sunset and admiring it. But then the other thing that I want to ask, it's sort of the follow-up to that, is it also seems like the wealthier we have gotten, the better we have gotten at managing the environment. Per capita emissions are way down. I mean, just on most metrics, wealthier societies tend to be better for the environment than these kind of middle ground societies where they are moving into the industrial, deep into industrial revolution, right?
I was at a plant in India that was bragging about its emissions control. Yeah. And emissions control was like the ash went on the ground. Like literally, it was just a pile of ash on the ground, as opposed to in the air. But, of course, they have wind in India, too.
So it doesn't seem crazy to care about the environment. And why can't people who do care about the environment, why do so few of them want to have a richer, wealthier, better society that is better prepared to be good for the environment?
So I think you have to differentiate between, first of all, the general public and what the general public thinks about the environment. That's your view there, And that's something, the richer you get, the more you want. So if you're really rich, you want to live in this penthouse. You want to buy, Ted Turner's bought up watersheds all over the U.S. So there's that. And so and for a society, because environmental harms are not necessarily internalized, you end up with some public policies, and there are better and worse ways to doing them. The other thing that happens is the same technological drivers that lead to progress, that same form follows failure kind of innovation, also produces better and better ways of doing things with fewer and fewer side effects. Or you use less materials. I mean, when I worked at Reason, my colleague Lynn Scarlett used to go around tearing soda cans in half to show how little material they had in them nowadays. So you have like a demand side and also a supply side. So as you get richer, you can do more environmental preservation, and you want to do more environmental preservation.
Jim, why is there this conflict between environmentalism or this perceived conflict, I should say, between environmentalism and progress?
We've been talking a little bit about climate change. What do you view the problem as? How do you frame the problem? I frame it as a clean energy problem. If you think of it that way, then it leads you to a certain set of solutions. You begin to think about solar and wind, but you think a lot about nuclear fission, maybe nuclear fusion, maybe deep geothermal, which we're still trying to figure out. You think about that sort of solution set. But perhaps that's not really the problem. Maybe climate change is a consequence of something else. Just as in the 70s, they thought that using up all the resources was a consequence of something else. And what that something else was, that the dominant socio-economic system on the Earth is capitalism, and that demands ever more consumption. And I recently watched a miniseries on Apple Plus called Extrapolations, big budget miniseries. Meryl Streep was in it. The guy who played Jon Snow from Game of Thrones was in it. And what it looked at was, and it was by the person who made the big Outbreak movie with Matt Damon that we watched.
Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah, Steven Soderbergh. I always forget the name of the movie. Contagion. So it was supposed to be a very sort of hard science look at the problem of climate change. And each episode was like the 2030s, 2040s. And I watched it and I wrote about it. Never mentioned in that entire miniseries was the option of building nuclear power. And by the last episode, all the CEOs were put on trial for war crimes. This was not made in the 70s. It was made recently, and you can look around, and you can look at how safe nuclear has been, and you can look at, if you wanted to do some extrapolations, you could be extrapolating about new kinds of reactors or nuclear fusion. That view never penetrated anybody who made that show. That was a show which had where the creators had a 1970s and then skipped right to the 2020s and failed to notice anything that happened. So that's how I look at it. What do you view as the problem? Do you view the problem as generating clean energy that won't pollute the air? Or do you really view it as a capitalism problem? I think a lot of people really view it as a capitalism problem.
So that's a good segue because I think a lot of what we're circling around here are both not just the kind of specific policy and technological problems, but problems of cultural attitudes. And we're using fiction as a stand-in to talk about those attitudes and how we process them as a society. And of course, because we're talking about the future, a lot of that ends up being science fiction. So I know both of you have at times written about the science fiction author Neal Stephenson, who is somebody who is dear to my heart. I'm a big fan. And Neal Stephenson, over the last decade or so, has spent a lot of energy. Not nuclear energy, sadly, a lot of energy talking about how science fiction has lost the future. And it no longer presents these big, sweeping visions of the future that compel people like, oh, I want to go there. And the idea is, oh, well, science fiction used to inspire invention. Obviously, one of the most obvious examples of this is Isaac Asimov, who wrote a lot about robots and then inspired the founder of the actual company, U.S. Robotics. And in fact, Isaac Asimov was somebody who wrote his robot stories explicitly against kind of anti-progress ideas of robots. He talked about how when he was a young science fiction consumer, virtually all robot stories fit into one of two categories, either robots as pathos or robots as menace, basically a kind of Frankenstein story, or they're just sort of these needy little baby type creatures who we need to love. And he was like, no, they're not. That's not how we should think about robots. Robots are machines that help us and they save labor. And that's what robots are for. And so in some ways, this debate, and sort of this conflict has been with us. I mean, Isaac Asimov was writing these stories in the 1940s and 1950s. But I guess, to wrap up here, I want to ask both of you, what are the ideal sort of pop culture forms? What kind of pop culture should we be looking for? And what pop culture, maybe this is the question I'm trying to ask, what is the single piece of pop culture that best exemplifies your ideal of the future? What should we be watching or reading or looking at to see what Jim Pethikoukas thinks the future should be like?
Well, first, if you think this is silly, what does it really matter? What kind of images of the future that science fiction presents? Every single story about ChatGPT brings up the Terminator as its sort of go-to cultural reference. So this isn't like a 70s, and most of the stories about pausing AI, so this isn't like a 70s thing. This is right now where that's the image people have. And I think, when I think about other than, people point to Star Trek, but I think something like The Expanse. The Expanse was a TV series. Jeff Bezos liked it, so Sci-Fi canceled it. They brought it over to Amazon. And a great book
series. Bless him.
Yeah, really. And also, he's obviously a massive Star Trek fan. And I write about this show as being future optimistic. It takes place a couple hundred years in the future. We live longer. We have these fusion drives, which make it, relatively easy for us to go out and mine the asteroid belt. And I'm like, well, that's great. That's future optimistic. But people say, no, that is not future optimistic. There are still problems in that future. There was climate change. There's a lot of unemployment on the Earth. The Earth and the Mars and Mars, which is his own world and colony, and the people who live out in the asteroid belt, they don't get along. That's a future with problems. That is not future optimistic. I'm like, okay, well, that's not my vision. My vision is not a utopia. As long as there's humans, we're not going to have a utopia. But that is an example of a humanity which has problems. Climate change happened. New York there's a big seawall in front of New York, but they kept on striving, moving forward. They invented new technologies. Maybe some of those technologies cause problems, such as if you can go across the whole solar system, and you're not all together on the Earth, and maybe Mars and the Earth, and maybe they're all not going to get along. But we're still here. Life is getting better, and it's that kind of moving forward. You get a problem, you solve that problem, that solution causes another problem, but you keep moving forward. That's my sort of non-utopian progress. But if what you're expecting is utopia, then yeah, that looks like a hellscape.
Virginia?
Yeah.
What piece of pop culture?
Yeah. First, I have to say this is a very important point about utopia, because a lot of these so-called inspiring visions of the future are de facto utopian. They're glamorous, as I would say in my book. They leave out the difficulties, which are always part of life. I love The Expanse also. It's a great show. I think Stevenson's Diamond Age is the most accurate kind of take on future trends, good
I'm
and
I'm so glad you said the Diamond Age and not Snow Crash.
Oh no,
because it's, as good
it's
as
like
Snow a, Crash
it's
is,
like 10
the
times,
Diamond Age is
it's
so much
10
better.
Times better than
and
Snow
so
Crash. And
so much more predictive of the world we live in.
However, I will note that Stevenson also wrote a 3-volume, very long trilogy, which I believe it or not have listened to twice, called The Baroque Cycle, about the 17th century. And I think if
about
you
about monetary policy, kind
some of.
Of
it was about monetary policy. But I think that if you want people to be inspired about what the future can be, they have to know what the past was like. And that one of the problems is when we talk about people in the mid 20th century and why they could be optimistic, it's because they knew how things had changed. And people who have no sense of the past cannot perceive progress because they have no basis of comparison. All they know is the future, is the present, and what they don't like about it. And they are prey to diagnoses that say all those things that you don't like about your life, they are because of technology, markets, money, whatever, democracy, you know, liberalism, we would say, you know, and that is very dangerous.
So I will end with my pick for the world that most reflects my, for the pop culture world that most reflects my vision of the ideal of the future, and it's Ian M. Banks's culture novels. So he wrote 8 or 10 or so, and there's one novel that is not officially in the series, but is kind of acknowledged to be an unofficial part of the series because it is about a very, very far future in which the resource problem has been completely solved. Everything is as free as you want it to be. You can live forever. You can live as a man or a woman, or maybe as a whale, if you'd really like to live as a whale. There's just simply no limit. There's except what you can imagine and what you want. And sentient machines sort of guide all governance, right? It's a kind of anarchist utopia where basically the only rules are like, don't hurt people without their consent. And that's really about it. You don't even have to worry about theft because literally anything you imagine can be brought to you at any point because the resource problem has still been solved. And guess what? People still aren't happy. And it's delightful because you find that even in this world of infinite, of true infinitude, people still find ways to get in trouble and be upset. But at the same time, you also see that it has freed people to just focus on the things that they want to focus on. And the people who take advantage of this most are those who are like, well, this is the opportunity for me to do anything I want, including, as one character in one of the novels does, basically lives as a kind of a whale soul clone copy for about 900 years and then is like, I'm tired of this. Maybe I'm going to go run a sort of a mousetrap of sand on a whole planet for... Anyway, it's incredibly delightful and complicated. And the idea, but the basic idea is, what if we actually had every single thing that we could want and desire at any given moment? What would happen then? Well, we'd still want things. And so this is my, like, I think about this as sort of an anti-utopian utopia and about the limits of it pretty regularly. And in fact, those books have inspired some of our biggest tech entrepreneurs. Elon Musk in particular has said he is an Ian M. Banks, basically a culturarian. So if you haven't read the books, they're delightful. I actually wrote about them for Reason after Banks died a few years ago. I believe we have a little bit of time to take questions here. I don't know if we have a microphone that we want to spread around the audience, but I don't. I see somebody from Reason who's making pointing noises, pointing faces.
Yeah,
pointing.
Also, we can't really see you, so, you know.
A microphone up there. Up there. It's hiding. There we go. Okay, great. So if you want to come up and ask your question into the microphone so that everybody can hear. Hi. Yeah, it's going to be really, really close.
Hi. There have, of course, been futurists from the past, including, as Jim mentioned, Alvin Toffler. Are there any futurists from, say, 50 years ago that you think were particularly insightful, looking back?
50 years ago, so that's the 1970s. Yes.
Yeah. I write a bit about Walt Disney in the book, but he is not my sort of, you know, go-to, you know, since the name of the book is The Conservative Futurist, he is not my go-to conservative future. My go-to conservative futurist is Herman Kahn, the nuclear war theorist of the 60s turned into sunny 1970s techno-capitalist futurist. And as I quote him in the book, made a living. He would give scenarios, and they did a lot of calculations. He's one of the first people to give a lot of to really do kind of long-term growth forecasts. But when it came down to it, what he said was, "Look, if we get a little bit of luck and don't make some horrible decisions, we can make it through." So I think that's what he was right. That's what we haven't had horrible luck. We've made a few good decisions. And we've gone this far. So what happens if the luck holds out and we start making a lot better decisions? I think we'd have a lot better future. And that's kind of what my book's about, is making better decisions.
Virginia, 50 years ago, futurists?
I don't think he would consider himself a futurist, but Stuart Brand.
Absolutely.
Did the Whole Earth Catalog and is just a very generative thinker and has a wonderful book called How Buildings Learn.
Huge influence on reason. I would go with Norman Spinrad, the science fiction writer.
From the 70s?
He wrote a couple of books in the mid to late 70s and then also into the early 1980s. And he was a sort of, he was a hippie. And he accepted he had a positive worldview. And so he looked at solar power and he looked at maybe we would make a bunch of mistakes, but basically people, by inventing things and by accepting that technology could make our lives better, all of his books were about this idea, basically about the conflict between a sort of quasi-religious cultural aversion to technology and then the realization that that true freedom requires us to accept the things that people make and the things that people build, and that is a big part of what makes our lives better.
Well, shout out to Curiosity. I'm actually a NASA engineer, and
sweet.
Interestingly enough, outside of the rocket science, I actually became a relationship coach in the district, and so I'm just curious from both of you. What I find from my clients when it comes to the dating market, not having families like we used to, less children, and really how I think Gen Z specifically are becoming more satisfied with digital online relationships. I never see you, you never see me. So I just kind of curious about family dynamics in terms of the work you guys have been doing.
Yeah, that's a fabulous question. Not that I have a very good answer to it, but I think it's a really good question because it reminds us, that the social aspect, the family dynamics, personal relationships, all of these things are part of the evolution. It's not just about hardware, software, chemicals, et cetera. And I do think that people are always groping toward better arrangements as well. I mean, I recently listened to the fabulous George Eliot book, Middlemarch, which I'd read in college, and it was, it's a great book. And it just reminds you how different expectations for marriage and money and all of those things once were, in the 19th century. I don't know where things are going. I met my husband when I was 18, 45 years ago. So I'm like, this is very far from me. I don't have kids though, so I'm part of that. And I do think that, a lot of people are worried about declining fertility, but as long as you expect women to build their careers in their 30s, productivity is gonna, fertility is gonna decline. So I think, you're gonna have to figure out some way to address that. I don't know if it's a technological fix, a work fix, and relationship fix, but if people aren't going to be pairing off and having kids when they're 20 or younger, the world's going to be different.
Jim?
Yeah. Last year was the 50th anniversary of the film Soylent Green. Hopefully I'm not going to feel bad about spoiling a 50-year-old movie. But soy,
what happens at the
soy,
end?
Well, it's pretty shocking stuff. Soylent Green is made out of people. Economic growth, and a lot of my book is about economic growth. And fundamentally, economic growth, much like Soylent Green, though not exactly like, is also made out of people. The way I view an economy is an economy connects businesses and universities and big companies, small companies, government, and all those are made up of people who have ideas, who work together, who collaborate. But at the center of that, at the core of that, are people. So it's really, really important that we have people who are healthy, both physically, mentally, and emotionally, as the foundation of the future. And what that means exactly and how we create those kinds of people, think of it this way. How much time do we spend, how much money do we spend trying to figure out the best way to educate kids, maybe with not fantastic results? We should be spending at least as much money on research about how to create very healthy, well-adjusted kids who become well-adjusted adults. There's a great book out by an economist from the University of Maryland, Melissa Kearney, who looks at this issue and the kinds of family arrangements that probably produce healthy kids. So I think that really matters, both for the kids and the kind of society that we have.
I really think the idea that somebody is a relationship coach, that's a job, just like the idea that a personal trainer is a job.
A relationship coach and a NASA engineer?
Yes, and a NASA engineer. But I mean, there are other people I'm sure do it full time. But that these are jobs. I mean, this just shows how value can come out of in unexpected ways.
We could do an entire hour just on the effects of technology on relationships, fertility, family formation. It's a whole panel unto itself. I guess I would say that I think that obviously technology has changed relationships, and in particular, romantic relationships. I think in some ways it's changed it for better. Matching is probably in some cases a little easier for people, just because you have a much wider pool. In other ways, it may be worse, or at least people may feel worse about it. But that goes back to two points that we've already made here tonight. One is that the future and a future defined by new technology is not necessarily going to be utopian. People will find some way to be dissatisfied. But in that dissatisfaction, that dissatisfaction will plant the seeds of what comes next. And what comes next will be another technology and another way of doing things that hopefully will mitigate some of the things that frustrate people about how the world works right now. And so I don't think, those of us who are pro-future and who are technological optimists should discount the ways that sometimes technology can produce outcomes that people don't like. And on the other hand, we should be able to acknowledge that that's not a permanent state, and that it's always changing, and that the world, the next technology, if people don't like this technology, if they find it upsetting, then that's a market opportunity for someone to create a better technology, one that does a better job of matching and creates better outcomes for more people. Kent?
Thank you, Peter. This is wonderful, so thank you both. I wonder, in a world that we live with 8 billion people, if you think our future is being built and created and invented in America, where we've heard about all of the references that you've given from Toffler to Kahn, or is it going to be happening somewhere else, in Singapore, in Montreal, in China, in wherever? So what are the futurists and the work and the technologies and the social arrangements that are being developed now outside of America that we need to pay attention to? Thank you.
Virginia?
Well, I was very optimistic about China for a long time, and definitely about because it was on a trajectory toward more liberalization, but that ended quite a while ago. And I was not just when I say I was optimistic about China, I don't just mean about China in China. I mean, when you have all this brain power and talent released to cross-fertilize with the rest of the world and to, you know, whether people are coming here or whether people are working with people there, you can get an explosion of innovation. However, Mr. Xi seems not to like that. And so he is ruining China. And, you know, it's going to be bad. It's going to be very bad for the Chinese. And that's even assuming no, you know, international conflagration. But I do think that we shouldn't just talk about the, I mean, the U.S. at this point is a very dynamic, is still a dynamic place and a place that the future could be built. And it's not alone in being a place where the future can be built. And there are definite hazards here. I mean, there are a lot of people who want to turn inward just and who will do anything to hold on to power. I won't say it's like the CCP, but you know, you can shoot yourself in the foot as well.
Jim?
I'll tell you the thing I've been thinking about is, so I think it was last November that OpenAI released ChatGPT. And, you know, what if it had not been OpenAI? What if it had been Tencent or Alibaba or some Chinese company? What would be the reaction in America? I mean, if everybody is sick to death about hearing about AI and how to write a great prompt or whatever, or you know, images from Midjourney, that we would be talking about AI even more, about how we lost the AI race. It would have been like Sputnik. What did we do wrong? Why are we 3 years behind China? Is there a national security disadvantage? We would be in a panic. So instead, it's just the opposite. So supposedly, China is several years behind us, and who knows if they'll ever catch up.
And the regime there is too much into control to allow anything like that.
Yes, I think.
Despite its military applications, potentially.
So I want the United States to be on the technological frontier, and I want us to continue to push forward. I want the United States to be, as Elon Musk has said, if you want to do anything great with your life, there's no better place to go than the United States of America. I want that to continue, and that's one of the reasons I wrote my book, was hopefully in my own small little way, put a little nudge to making sure that that continues to be the case and is more the case in the future.
I am bullish on America. For the reasons one of the big reasons that you gave us earlier, which is that progress is people, and America is the place where people want to go. And so as long as that is the case, America is going to be the place that innovates and that has the upper hand when it comes to developing technology.
That's the deep magic, that people can come here.
Just because people want to come here doesn't mean we'll let them.
Need to let them, and they need to come here, and they need to be able to do things and create and build and be rewarded. And if that is still the case, I'll take my chances with the tax code.
I love it. All right. Thank you all very much. I believe that is all the time we have this evening, but we will be around. Jim, Virginia, delightful. Check out the men's bathroom.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please, before you do anything else, go to Apple, Google, Spotify, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe. Don't miss a single episode. Or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there, not just for this show, but for all our other great podcasts. And remember, this is the Reason Webathon, so go to reason.com/donate and make a tax-deductible donation to Reason if you like what you hear. Thanks for listening.